From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! 9 members of Nepal's royal family are gunned down, and the slain king's brother takes power as thousands of Nepalese march in the streets demanding an explanation. Then part 2 of our interview with Chilean novelist, playwright, and activist Ariel Dorfman as he talks about globalism, voyeurism, and responsibility. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Peruvians elected an economist as their next president in a vote that highlighted persisting racial divisions in a land where Spanish conquistadors defeated the ancient Inca Empire. With 3/4 of the vote counted early today, Alejandro Toledo had defeated Alan Garcia. International observers said Sunday's runoff election was Peru's cleanest vote in years. Toledo was a shoeshine boy who rose from poverty to become a World Bank economist before entering politics. He'll become Peru's first freely elected president of Indian descent and probably the first president ever in Latin America who made Indian pride a cornerstone of his campaign. Hours after winning Peru's presidential elections, the U.S.-educated economist Toledo said he would seek to renegotiate about 20% of Peru's foreign debt. At the same time, he, who is a firm free market advocate, pledged Peru would respect its international commitments. He said he would leave on an international tour before assuming the presidency on July 28th in a bid to attract investments and discuss Peru's foreign debt. Iraq has stopped exporting oil in protest of UN sanctions. The Iraqi government had threatened to cut off the flow because the UN extended by 1 month instead of 6 the oil for food program. War and sanctions have crippled the Iraqi economy, leaving many Iraqis dependent on government rations financed by the UN-supervised oil exports. Iraq has cash reserves, but it was unclear how long it could survive without further sales. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia signed agreements with 9 international oil companies yesterday, a move that marks the first major foreign investment in its energy sector since nationalizing the industry in 1975. The deal, worth at least $25 billion, involves the development of 3 natural gas fields in the kingdom and a number of related power plants, transmission pipelines, and water desalinization projects. The Texas-based ExxonMobil Corporation, the world's largest publicly traded oil company, is the lead manager on 2 of the projects. More than 2,000 people marched in Cincinnati Saturday to peacefully protest economic conditions and police treatment of African Americans, where protests broke out in April after an unarmed black man was shot by a white police officer. The protesters travel through the poor, predominantly African-American neighborhood where 19-year-old Timothy Thomas was shot on April 7th. Thomas's mother, Angela Leisure, led the procession that stretched 5 city blocks. People of all races joined in the demonstration, chanting, "No justice, no peace, no racist police." This news from Los Angeles in the final weekend of campaigning before tomorrow's mayoral election. An emotional Antonio Villaraigosa kept up his attacks on frontrunner James Hahn for what he called Hahn's campaign of fear and smear. Hahn continued to defend an advertisement that uses an image of a crack pipe held to a flame to slam Villaraigosa for writing a letter on behalf of a convicted cocaine trafficker whose sentence was later commuted by President Clinton. Villaraigosa is a charismatic one-time high school dropout, an immigrant son who rose to become Speaker of the California State Assembly. If elected, he would be the city's first Latino mayor since 1872, even as new census figures show Latinos now comprise 46.5% of Los Angeles's population. Senate Republicans say they'll give up control of Senate committees without a fight if Democrats agree not to reject or delay President Bush's judicial nominees. Pennsylvania Republican Rick Santorum says Democrats should guarantee that Bush's nominees get a vote on the floor rather than being rejected by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Santorum has threatened a GOP filibuster to stop Democrats from adjusting committees if that doesn't happen. And Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott tossed a parting grenade as he leaves the office of the Majority Leader. On Saturday, he declared that Republicans must, quote, begin to wage the war against Democrats when they take control of the Senate next week. The comments were part of a memorandum to Republican opinion leaders that his office released to the press. In Lott's call to action in what he called a great and worthy struggle, he said his party must energetically push its agenda and protect Bush's priorities, not let the Democrats amass too much power in the reorganization of the Senate or regain the majority in 2002. He also stepped up his criticism of Jeffords and the, quote, impetuous decision of one man to undermine our democracy. And according to new financial disclosures released on Friday, at least three top White House advisors involved in drafting President Bush's energy strategy held stock in the Enron Corporation or earned fees from the large Texas-based energy trading company, which lobbied aggressively to shape the administration's approach to energy issues. They're Karl Rove, Bush's chief political strategist, Lawrence Lindsay, the top economic coordinator, and I. Lewis Libby, Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff. Lindsay received $50,000 last year from Enron for consulting. Rove's statement said he intended to sell stock holdings in Enron valued at $100,000 to $250,000. The administration's energy strategy issued last month recommended opening protected lands to oil and gas drillers, building hundreds of power plants, and easing some environmental controls, measures strongly favored by the industry. It suggested that the federal government exercise more power over electricity transmission networks, a longtime Enron goal. Enron was one of the largest contributors to Bush's presidential campaign. Kenneth Lay, the chairman, has close ties to Bush and his father. Lay and other Enron officials interviewed several candidates to fill vacancies on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which regulates Enron's main markets. Bush selected two people for the panel who were favored by Enron and some other energy companies. The financial disclosures for senior White House aides show that many of Bush's top advisors are millionaires. Among the wealthiest are Rove, Lindsay, Libby, and Andrew Carr, the chief of staff, who earned close to $500,000 as chief lobbyist for General Motors and reported assets of $810,000 to $2.1 million. Mary Madeline, Cheney's senior counselor and a former political commentator, reported income of more than $1.5 million last year from speaking fees and television appearances. Her husband, James Carville, a Democratic commentator and political advisor, made $2.1 million last year on the speaking circuit.
Life you make a whole lot of fools, 'cause you're always teaching something that they never teach in school. Somebody's gotta suffer, somebody's gotta feel some pain.
Love, Life, and Money, Marianne Faithfull, from the CD Strange Weather. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. On Friday night, nine members of the royal family of Nepal were shot dead at the royal palace in the capital city of Kathmandu. Senior government officials claim that Nepal's Crown Prince Dipendra killed his parents, King Birendra, and Queen Aishwarya, as well as his sisters and other relatives, before turning a gun on himself. According to palace sources, Dipendra shot the family after his mother rejected his plans to marry the daughter of another leading Nepali family. The late king and the royal family were cremated on Saturday. King Birendra enjoyed great popularity in Nepal, especially after ceding absolute power in 1990 to establish a constitutional monarchy. But Nepal has been racked by political instability in recent years and a Maoist insurgency that has killed nearly 2,000 people. Many in Nepal refuse to believe that Crown Prince Dipendra killed the royal family and then himself. They're more incredulous at the second explanation offered by the slain king's brother Gyanendra, that the deaths were a freak accident caused by an exploding automatic weapon. How can a gun go off and shoot a dozen people in all different directions? Asked a rickshaw driver in Kathmandu. This is ridiculous. Thousands of people demonstrated in the streets of Kathmandu yesterday, demanding an explanation for the killings. They were dispersed by police using tear gas. The military has imposed a shoot-on-site policy for anyone breaking a dusk-to-dawn curfew. Armed riot police surround Nepal's royal palace, as well as the hospital where three survivors of the massacre are recovering. Nepal's governing state council met this morning and proclaimed Gyanendra, the brother of the king, as the new monarch. Interestingly, the entire family of Gyanendra, the new king, was not killed. Gyanendra was out of town. His wife was in the palace bathroom when the massacre took place. His son just wasn't shot, and his mother, the queen mother, also survived. Most people in Nepal, unsatisfied with official accounts, continue to demand a full explanation for the weekend massacre. We're joined right now by two experts on Nepal. We'll begin with Anu Pahari, who is an American-trained sociologist from Nepal. Dr. Pahari, what do people believe right now?
Amy, thanks for having me this morning. You know, in Nepal, as you pointed out in your report, people don't know what to believe at this point. There have been, in the last 48 hours, 3 days period, have been inundated with conflicting reports. Initially, it was informally circulated that the Crown Prince was absolutely and the only person responsible for this. That was what was mouthed by the Home Minister, Mr. Podal. He retracted it later on, saying he actually didn't know who did this. There were apparently survivors in the hospital, some of whom were injured to the point where they couldn't talk, but others who were not. But there have not been any systematic statements from any of the survivors as to exactly what happened. The army has pretty much closed down all avenues of information, both in the hospital and in the royal palace. And so people in Nepal don't know what to believe. However, because in large part due to the way in which this whole crisis and its aftermath has been handled in terms of its information flow, people have a grave suspicion that something is remiss here. I mean, something has gone terribly wrong and that they're not being told. And this will not be the first time in Nepali history that something as gruesome as this has happened, perpetrated by, you know, who knows who, and the people have been out of the loop. I mean, this happened throughout the, you know, 19th century, middle of the 19th century. And it, you know, it continued to happen until about, you know, 10 years ago when democracy was... So my point is that misinformation from the state, from the army, from the palace is the rule rather than the exception. Now, one has to wonder whether this is simply, you know, a face-saving mechanism or there is something there. But the point is, you know, people are not, just not sure, but they have a grave suspicion.
Now, rioting broke out today in Kathmandu, Nepal's capital, just after the new king was crowned. I wanted to turn to Ted Ricciardi, retired Columbia University professor, former chair of Middle East and Asian Languages and Cultures Department, to talk about just who the newly ascended king, Gyanendra, is, and what is little reported, that his whole immediate family, his son, his mother, his wife, none of them died in the massacre.
No.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, Amy. All I can tell you is that Gyanendra is a figure who, unlike his brother, is one who is probably feared most in the Nepalese nation. There's one interesting thing about him was that he was king for a day, so to speak, in the 50s when King Tribhuvan fled to Delhi, protected by Jawaharlal Nehru. The Ranas, who were in control of the government at the time, made Gyanendra king. He was about 2 years old. I think Anu Pahari can fill us in.
I think he was about four.
Okay, he was about four, but they minted coins, I think. They took all kinds of pictures. They went through a coronation ceremony. And then, of course, Tribhuvan returned, and Gyanendra was... no longer king. People say that he harbored, or he has harbored throughout his whole life, the desire to be king again, and frankly, it's happened unexpectedly in a way that no one would have predicted. And it's very difficult to say why and how this happened. We may never know unless credible witnesses come forward. We're probably never going to really know what happened. And what Anup Pahari said about previous massacres of this kind, this is part of, unfortunately, part of the Nepalese tradition. And the army is in control. I gather the prime minister cannot even go near the hospital. And we just have to wait until we see what's happened. One thing last night I heard is that this massacre may be much larger than we thought. As many as 50 people may have been killed, although I don't know if there's any basis for that rumor. But clearly there must have been people of all kinds, attendants, servants, whatnot, in that room when it took place. And this is also something that people are saying is being quieted. Gyanendra is now king. This is basically a victory, regardless of how it happened, a victory for the right wing, the conservative people, who were in control of the government before the revolution in 1990.
Anup Pahari, let's talk about that revolution in 1990 and what the monarchy is all about today in Nepal.
Well, in 1990, you know, Nepali people, you know, waged, you know, an intensive 18-month, year-long, you know, people's, you know, struggle to bring the monarchy where it was until Birendra expired a couple of days ago, which is to say that, you know, Birendra conceded you know, the basic parameters of a constitutional ruler, and pretty much for the last 10 years lived within those bounds, is my understanding, and which is one of the reasons that the King Birendra had managed successfully to rehabilitate some of the image of his personal ruler, rule in Nepal, and to some extent of the monarchy itself, which is why the outpouring in Kathmandu, you know, of grief and sympathy is my understanding is you know, cuts across all kinds of you know, age groups and ethnic groups and you know, so on and so forth, and that is largely because the king has abided by the basic premise of constitutional rulership in Nepal. Now that was a negotiated deal with Birendra. What view Gyanendra takes of the constitutional setup is anybody's guess. As Professor Riccardi pointed out, Gyanendra is a different man with a different history. And the circumstances by which he has come into power is, as again Professor Riccardi pointed out, highly questionable to say the least. And so it would not surprise me if he takes exception to some fundamental portions of that constitutional settlement back in 1990, or begins to try in gradual and you know, form ways to systematically undermine that. On the other hand, he may not. We won't know for the next few weeks at least, if not months, what view he takes. But as it stands right now, I guess we have to assume that the negotiated settlement between the political parties, the people, you know, and the monarchy of 1990 stays and is holding, you know, because there is no indication otherwise at this point. But again, you know, given Nepal's history, anything has happened in the past and anything can happen. And I think, as Professor Koi pointed out, you know, although this is not an outright and active victory by the right wing, let me just put it this way. The right wing is poised and is placed in a different position today than it was yesterday.
That's right.
And exactly what they will do remains to be seen, but it is not the same monarchy of yesterday.
The Maoist insurgency that has claimed some 2,000 lives, how does that fit into this picture, Professor Riccardi?
Well, I think what we have now is a very much increased possibility of a direct confrontation between a much more conservative, hardline group in control in the army and in the palace, a group that probably would, I think, contrary to Birendra and the civilian government, go after the Maoist insurgency. This insurgency began, I think, around 1993, 94. It grew out of a couple of splinter leftist radical groups. It's run by a man named Comrade Prachand. The Prachand means something like a fierce, fiery, whatever. And it is very, very successful. It has a tremendous following in Western Nepal. And it remains to be seen what's going to happen. Again, Gyanendra may take a view that he is a successor to Birendra and keep those policies. Frankly, I doubt it. I think there is the increased possibility of a direct confrontation now between the Maoists and the army.
Dr. Pahari, where Nepal is geographically, and then its relationship with countries like China?
Nepal is about a 700-800 mile, rectangular strip, that sort of, rises up from the Indian plains right up to the Tibetan plateau. And that is, separates Tibet from the rest of the Indian plains. And so strategically, Nepal has always been, this very key, territory in South Asia from the time of the British. It was a buffer between the Chinese, Tibetan plateau, and India. And so from that angle, I think India is obviously watching this extremely carefully because, I was reading on the Internet, the prospect of having to, having a Maoist government in Kathmandu would mean that they have now almost a 1,000-mile border to actively guard, whereas right now I think, the Indian government feels that a constitutional monarchy in Nepal with a parliamentary democracy is something that is more manageable in terms of defense. So, yes, Nepal's location is an extremely, crucial thing in this whole thing. I don't know what exactly you are getting to, but that is a sense I get.
The acceptance of Gyanendra, the new king, do you think it's going to happen by the Nepali people? You have the military surrounding the hospital. You don't have forensic investigation going on right now. Thousands of people in the streets rioting, being met by a shoot-to-kill policy.
Well, as things stand right now, the circumstances by which he's been crowned is so bizarre and under such cover that it would be hard to believe that there would be any voluntary acceptance of this transition by the masses. Now, of course, there's going to be an attempt, whether or not there was a conspiracy. Gyanendra is a suspect candidate in Nepali royal family, So even if there were no conspiracy, this would be a difficult transition.
Right.
And secondly, his son has done an incredible job of putting the family in disrepute. His son is Paras. This gentleman has been involved in numerous street shootings and brawls and so on and so forth, and is absolutely infamous in Nepal. And there have been, in the past, I believe, a 500,000-page signature by citizens demanding investigations into his various, mischiefs.
And he was at the Friday night dinner, but just didn't happen.
Just didn't get hurt.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the fact that, it's not only up to Gyanendra, because, he cannot now disinherit his son. His son is his son, and his son has done what he has done. And so even if it was not a conspiracy, this is an extremely difficult situation for him. Now if evidence begins to trickle out that, in fact, there may have been more going on than what is reported, it's going to be an absolutely chaotic and unpredictable thing. And then you have to bring into this whole equation and calculus what view the Maoists are taking of this. And my understanding is that the Maoists have come out, categorically by a statement from their leadership saying that, they smell a rat in this and that this is the ongoing conspiracy of the ruling elite in Nepal.
Well, we'll see if the monarchy even survives with the survivors. I want to thank you both for being with us. Dr. Anup Pahari, sociologist from Nepal, and Ted Riccardi, former chair of the Middle East and Asian Languages and Cultures Department at Columbia University. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak to Ariel Dorfman. Stay with us. listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In our continuing series on Arden Revolution, we'll complete our interview with Ariel Dorfman, the acclaimed Chilean novelist, playwright, and activist. Today, he'll talk about his new book, Blake's Therapy, where he confronts the implications of globalization and the culture of voyeurism. In order to write his book, Dorfman actually attended the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, a meeting of global business and political leaders. The book is being released simultaneously in Spanish and English. The protagonist is Graham Blake, who owns Clean Earth Inc., a company that manufactures vitamins and herbal remedies, and has branched out into ecotourism. Its stocks have soared, and it's called the company that saved the rainforest. But let's let Ariel Dorfman tell it again. Ariel Dorfman, born in Argentina, came to New York, then moved to Chile, where he became a citizen, close ally of President Salvador Allende, before he died in the coup that brought Pinochet to power. Ariel Dorfman, tell us about Graham Blake, the protagonist in your new book, Blake's Therapy.
Well, Graham Blake is a multimillionaire who has become, as the CEO, the marketing guru of Clean Earth Incorporated, he is sort of the perfect boss. I wanted to take, you know, the typical entrepreneur that is a villain in our fiction is always this sort of Scrooge person, right? The bad guy with a heart of gold. I wanted a guy with a heart of gold to begin with. And I wanted to submit him to a little experiment, which is this man who is very generous, very charitable, always worried about the earth. You know, he's sort of a guy who we would typically consider an ally in the search for a better world. I wanted to look at the dark side of such a person, both the dark side psychologically and the dark side allegorically, in the sense of taking a person and putting him in a very special situation. So Graham Blake goes into a mental breakdown and a terrible form of insomnia that he can't solve, he can't cure, when he has to downsize one of his factories. What I decide to make him do is he checks into the Corporate Life Therapy Institute, which is, I've made this up. Dr. Carl Tolgate is the main psychotherapist there. And he says to Blake, I can give you a clean conscience. You're going to sleep like a baby. But I need 28 days of your time. Totally at my orders. You've got to be subservient to whatever I do. And he submits him to a very unorthodox treatment. He puts him in a luxury apartment in Philadelphia, which is the place where Blake has downsized one of the factories there. And on the other side of a one-way mirror, one of those James Bond-like mirrors, and on the other side of a series of screens that are cameras that are picking up the life in an apartment next door, there is one of the families, the real-life family of somebody, of people that Blake has downsized, whose lives he's ruined by his decision to downsize that factory. And the doctor says to him, now you can do whatever you want with them. You're the god of that world. If you want to kill them, you can kill them. You don't have to kill them, he says, you know. You don't have to maim them. On the contrary, you can have them win the lottery. You can do this. You can do whatever you want with them. But you are going to be the hidden and silent god of that world. There's only one thing you cannot do, Dr. Tolgate says, and that is you cannot go over and contact your pre-selected family. This family of yours, this reality family of yours, is out of bounds. And of course, you know, the one thing that Blake decides that he has to do finally, because this is a thriller, right? He has to go over to the other side. He has to break through the screen. He has to go out of his building and into the next building and find his family, right? Of course, he's in love or obsessed with a specially sexy Latina who dances through life, who's a healer. And that's just the beginning of the novel, in the sense that this is the first stage of his therapy. Once he goes over to the other side, and I can't reveal too much more of what happens, strange things, even stranger things begin to happen. Each one is a process of his therapy, which consists, Dr. Tolgate keeps on saying, in discovering who the CEO really is. And what I've done, of course, is to put him in direct contact with the people whose lives he is determining. I mean, he's been determining their lives all along, you know, just by being the person that he is. He's been determining, in fact, you know, there are like 5 or 10,000 people around the world who determine the lives of the billions of the rest of us. they are the people who have most of the power in the world, most of the money in the world, most of the media power, most of the political power. There are not very many people who have that power. And even if you wanted to put it from the point of view of percentage of population, there's around 10% of the world that gets 80% of the world national gross, right? What about the others? So it's to put him in contact directly. In fact, first through the screen and through, you know, and through this one-way mirror. But then when he breaks through to the other side, it's to put him directly in contact with these people who are the real people that he's affecting. And of course, strange things begin to happen to him, among those strange things is that he becomes paranoid himself. In other words, he himself begins to ask a question, which is, I'm watching these people, I'm manipulating these people with my money, with my cameras, with my eyes. Who's watching me? Maybe I'm being set up. So it's a novel also of espionage, of industrial espionage, of corporate, you know, derring do, of takeovers and mergers and things like that.
Did you meet someone like your fictional character, Graham Blake, when you went to the Davos summit, the height, really, the meeting place of corporate executives and political leaders in Switzerland that was shaken to the core by the anti-globalization protests?
Well, in fact, no, I didn't. I went there. I really went there as a forum fellow and as a world cultural leader. And they do invite people who have doubts about globalization to have a dialogue with them, and I was very glad to be able to do part of that, you know, and I met many people. And no, I didn't meet anybody like Blake, though I suspect that perhaps there is a Blake inside some of them, you know. There's a Graham Blake. Graham Blake is the sort of the conscience that is submerged inside many of the entrepreneurs and many of the CEOs of the world, and which I think they have, in a great measure, they've either, I think what they've done is they've suppressed it or they've put it in a little part. For instance, let's say you do something terrible to a country and then you create a charitable trust to take care of some of the displaced children of that country, right? You know, schizophrenically you do that. So Blake is that component of their lives. I didn't find anybody in particular who was like Blake, but it did give me a very interesting insight into people with extraordinary power. And I went almost as you go on a safari, you know. I mean, an anthropologist who goes to study exotic customs. And the customs are, I mean, some of them are exotic and some of them are not. These are ordinary human beings with extraordinary powers. And I found that to be very, very interesting. But I had to invent Blake. I mean, I say that he came to me like like a muse in the global night, you know, and whispered in my ear and it's a novel. I mean, it's not an essay. It's not an indictment of globalization. It's what many of my books are. They are, my books and my plays tend to ask the questions of what are the consequences of moral dilemmas that we have. But rather than posing this in an essay-like way, I enact it. In other words, I want to put the reader in the place of a person like Blake. I want the reader to feel the uncertainty of being a Blake. And in a way, it's a very Latin American thing I'm doing, because this book, of course, is out in Spanish and in English simultaneously. Maybe we can speak about that in a few minutes. The fact is, I want the reader to feel what it's like not to know who's watching you. So I make the reader first a voyeur, and then as he or she goes deeper and deeper into the words of Blake, you grab a perspective and you begin to say, wait a second, who's watching Blake? Who's watching me? I mean, you know, we have no privacy in our world today. I don't know what cameras there may be. I doubt that there are many cameras in this studio, but who knows? There may be cameras watching us. There may be cameras watching us in our bathroom. You know, a few years ago, I thought there were some things which were sacred, for instance, were not ever captured on film. It turns out that I had to have an operation and I was mapped. There was a photographer who took a photograph of every part of my body, and then they put it inside a computer. So, you know, when you say there's maps of the world, there are eyes everywhere. And I'm a bit paranoid. I mean, I've got reason to be paranoid, after all, having been survived Pinochet's coup and then survived the years of resistance and exile after that. But I think that this is part of the problem of privacy. So I wanted to speak about privacy. But I didn't want to speak about privacy. I wanted us to feel our privacy invaded. And then once we are part of the invaders of that privacy, the invasion, I thought, I want to turn the thing around. I want us to feel as if we are being invaded at the same time. So the novel does both of those things. It enacts in language the process of not knowing what control you have about the world. I made Blake into a person who doesn't control the world, being a person who has much more power than anybody who's listening to this program.
I am curious, Ariel Dorfman, you said you were brought to Davos as a cultural leader, and you're in dialogue with these people. I mean, for example, you have a quote at the beginning of your book of George Soros.
Yes.
We have to distinguish between playing by the rules and making the rules. What those conversations consisted of that you had, and what is the point of those conversations? Is this to serve them?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I when you say serve them, I think that the more that you have a dialogue with the people who have power and who are interested in changing the world for the better, which they do want to do. I mean, I'm absolutely sure that most capitalists, if they could create profits without hurting others, they would do it. I mean, they're not people who decide to wake up in the morning and say, how are we going to hurt people, you know? No, how are we going to make money, and how are we going to create drugs that will help people and food that people need? I mean, they certainly see themselves in that sense, right? They don't see themselves as immoral at all. But I think many of them do have many moral qualms, and they ask themselves those questions. And so I bring some of those questions to them, and I listen to their answers very carefully.
Your point, saying that you're sure you...
I throw books at the windows of their mind and everybody else's mind. Because remember that we all have power over the people. The problem is that the people in Davos, or the people like Graham Blake, have enormous amount of power because power is so concentrated in our world. More and more in the global world is concentrated. And more in our world, there are barriers between those who have power and those who suffer that power. So what I want to do as a writer is I want to break down those barriers. What I do with Blake is I put him in direct contact with people. And then not only in direct contact through the screen, then I make him go over to the other side and live like the prince among the paupers, the prince among the peasants, the duke among his followers. That's what a writer, that's one of the things a writer can do. He can take you on a voyage that generally doesn't happen. But we live in a world of alienation. We have a world which is, we have a series of representations and screens and cameras and chauffeurs and guards and riches, basically. Wealth separates. Wealth is an enormous divide. Knowledge is an enormous divide between those who have and those who don't have. But the story of the relationship between those who have and those who do not have is a very interesting, I mean, I'm interested in it not only for political reasons, I'm interested in it because for dramatic human possibilities, it's just such a rich narrative story.
You say that the people you talk to, clearly their motivation isn't to hurt people. It's to do well in the world, and if they can do good, that's fine.
Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations. They think that's how wealth is created.
But if they do have to hurt people in the process, I guess the question is, will they and do they?
Well, two things happen. Some of them do it and justify it and say it's for the greater good, which is what Dr. Tollgate says about Blake. We're going to do horrible things to him, but it's to save him, right? The others say at a certain moment, they go into a crisis, they say, you know what? I don't want to have anything more to do with it. I can't take the stress. They are either rehabilitated, they go through management training or something of the sort, or they drop out. Now, the fact is, I'm interested in somebody who wants to stay in this business and who has a problem, by the way, because if Blake does not save his business, there is a very unscrupulous, horrible human being called Hank Granger who's going to take over his business, and that person has no scruples whatsoever. So Blake can very well say to himself, I'm saving my business by hurting some people, downsizing some people, because I want to keep it away from this guy who's going to downsize many more people, right? It all has to do with that logic. And the problem is that the world is constructed in such a way that immoral acts are almost necessary in order to survive. And I'm interested in that sort of world. But once again, I'm interested in the psychology and how that happens. And of course, I'm interested in the fact that he's obsessed with a Latina woman. And behind that, there's a relationship between a gringo Yankee and a Latino woman who dances through life, takes things very slow, who heals, who's in you know, in contact with nature and was very sexy. And therefore, he's obsessed with having her recognize his goodness. He wants the victim in some ways to look him in the eyes and say, you're a good man. It's as if, you know, I don't know, somebody who had done something terrible, but this happens to you all the time, you know, in our everyday life, in our existence. We do pretty terrible things to one another once in a while. And what we want to do finally is we want the person we've done something bad to say, it's okay, you know what, you can sleep okay, I'm over it. Blake wants the whole world to tell him that in some ways. I mean, it's a fiction, of course, but I think there must be some sort of a Graham Blake inside everybody, I suppose.
Ariel Dorfman, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. His latest book is Blake's Therapy. Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we continue with the Chilean playwright and author Ariel Dorfman. His latest book is Blake's Therapy. Ariel Dorfman, you are publishing this in both Spanish and English. Talk about the significance of that.
Well, you know, I am entirely bilingual. Quiero decir que soy enteramente bilingüe. In other words, I can go from one language to the other, and that isn't heading south, looking north. My memoir, I speak about how I became bilingual. But that means that every book of mine I write in two languages. I write in English first and then in Spanish, or then I write in first in Spanish and then in English. I rewrite the book in the other language and then correct it from the second version. I do this all the time. But never in my life had I ever brought out a book first in Spanish and in English in the States. All my books come out in five editions in Spain, in Colombia, in Chile, and in Argentina, in the Spanish-speaking world. But this is the first time it's ever come out first in the United States. The Argentine edition is coming out next month. So it's the first time I've written a book in Spanish in the States, having it here. There are 40 million Latinos in this country. I can't believe, you know, that there's not a 0.1% that does not want to read this sort of book. So that would make for quite an enormous amount of readership. And we're betting with Seven Stories Press, Siete Cuentos, that there is a readership for my books in Spanish here. They're bringing out Death and the Maiden in Spanish, my Heading South, Looking North book in Spanish. And what they're going to do in the future is they're bringing out every one of my backlist in Spanish and in English in the United States. It's an incredible experiment in that sense, because what we're saying is there is a readership, not only of Latinos, but of Anglo speakers who read Spanish, who might be interested in reading these books in Spanish.
What's the difference between Blake's Therapy and, is it
Therapia? Therapia. Well, you know, the difference is that, first of all, I wrote Blake's Therapy first in English. Then I wrote Terapia, which is the Spanish language version of it. And by the time I wrote Terapia, I already knew what the story was, right? Because it had already been written. It existed in a way. So I would say that Blake's Therapy has a bit more edge to it, tension. It's a bit more circumspect. Because
so it's not a direct translation?
No, it's a rewrite. It's a rewrite, but it's very similar, of course. I mean, because, you know, it's been written. I can't sort of make up another character. I'm not going to do that. So, you know, but the first version of it, as I say, is much more tentative, and I think a bit more, there's a bit more tension and suspense in it, in a way. But Terapia is richer and denser, because by then I already knew what the story was about, and therefore I could explore. It's a bit longer. I could weave in some themes that I already knew. So, you know, it begins by saying, I want to take a good look at him. I want to take a good, lazy look at Graham Blake. That's how the novel opens, with the voice of Dr. Carl Tolgate, which is an invitation for us to be voyeurs, you know, And then we realize that we're going to be looked at. We're being observed. But in Spanish, I like that idea about the laziness, etc. And I began saying, mírenlo de arriba abajo, de un lado por otro lado. In other words, I began to work with that. And so it became a bit longer. So, you know, I think that, in fact, each one of the versions is what each one of the languages is. You know, English is a much interesting language of synthesis. It gets the point much more directly. It has this incredible capacity to go for the jugular. And Spanish, you know, loves to go around things, you know. It doesn't quite want to say what it's saying. But you got to remember that my Spanish and my English are inhabited by the rival languages. In other words, at this very moment that I'm speaking to you, though I sound like a gringo, like I sound like somebody brought up in New York, which is what I was, it turns out that I am haunted inside by the Spanish language. And I am haunted, my Spanish is haunted by English. And that's why it's not entirely difficult. When I'm writing this in English, the Spanish is already whispering in my ear. I'm a bigamist of languages, and I'm in love with two languages, and I intend to service both of them as far as I'm able, up to the point of exhaustion, let's say.
Arl Dorfman, his book is Blake's Therapy, one of many books. You spoke on World Press Freedom Day, gave a major address.
At the UN General Assembly, yes.
What did you say?
I said two things. In other words, I spoke about the fact, let's say the central thing that I really said was the problem of fear is the central problem the press has got to face. We live in a world of fear. And all around the world, there are journalists who stand up with great courage and say the truth. And then all around the world, it is full of journalists who decide not to quite tell the whole truth because they're afraid. They're afraid of losing their job. They're afraid of losing their sources. They're afraid of not getting their raise. They're afraid of not being given the best position, the next best position. They're afraid of hurting the powers that be, right? So there's a sort of a relationship with, you could say, there's a relationship with the powerful of the world. And I'm saying, rather than blame them, we need to do something else. We need to say, what do we do? Why are we afraid? Where does it start? I always speak about people in power. And then I always speak about the people who surround the people in power. Because democracy is the capacity of the people to be sovereign and therefore the people to hold accountable those who have power. I don't only want to blame those who've got power. We should put the emphasis upon them, because when you're a journalist, you have more power than the person who you're reporting on, right? But the person who you're reporting on, the community you're reporting on, has got to be able to have a say in this as well. And so I go into the sense, well, listen, you know, what happens when a child is taught by the father, by the mother? The father says something, and the mother says, oh, keep quiet. The neighbors will hear you. They'll find out, right? Or what happens if somebody, you know, we're in the gay pride month, when they say, you know, don't tell them you're gay. Don't let them know. But those have to do with forms of fear, right? And so fear riddles the world. And I spoke about that in the UN, and then I read a poem, which had not been read, I think, on the floor of the General Assembly before. So I sort of felt good about that.
What was the poem?
It was called Simultaneous Translation. And what it said was, you know, that I'm not so different, and we're not so different from the simultaneous translators. What we do is we translate what terrible things happen in international conferences, you say. They put the woman on the cot and they put rats in her vagina. You translate that, right? What a translator does. So a translator translates that into perfect language, trying to keep the emotion out of the phrases, right? But you don't. And humanity finally has some sort of emotion in relation to that. I mean, once again, it's horrible. I don't want to, my gosh, I am quoting from one of my own poems. You never do that. So I've done a real no-no in that sense. You know, poems are poems. They're not, they can't be summarized, let's say. But that's more or less the gist of that poem.
you went to the World Economic Forum in Davos, but you also went to the World Social Forum, where we spoke to you on Democracy Now, where we spoke to you on Democracy Now for just a few minutes, where, 16, 17,000 activists were countering the Davos Forum. What was that like for you? You also gave a major address there.
Well, that was a very wonderful experience, a very interesting experience. The Davos was very interesting as well, and so was Porto Alegre, because Porto Alegre had no security at all. And it had thousands of people milling around. And though I felt that some of the speeches were very interesting, I thought what was most interesting was coming out of these places, of these fora, you know, these classrooms, really, enormous classrooms. And there you would see thousands of people interacting. It was like a beehive. You know how it is? It was very hot. So I immediately thought about the idea of atoms. And you know that when heat goes up, they begin to act and interact, the protons, the neutrons, they all like that. And then little explosions begin to happen. You know, that is how life happens, when the temperature goes up. And what I found extraordinary was I was watching a brain, like the brain of a little child, begin to form. I was watching all the synapses. That's what I felt. I felt this was the Congress of the Synapses, in which one person was connecting with another. A person on transparency in India was connecting with a person who was speaking about something similar in Brazil, and that person was speaking to somebody in Africa about AIDS, and the person who had been to the Seattle thing was speaking to Joseph Beauvais, who had come from the McDonald's thing, and they were all trying to figure out, because, you know, this is the truth, Amy, we have no idea whatsoever how to change the world. We got lots of very good, smaller ideas. I mean, we've got and a lot of big ideas. We need democracy. We need more control. We need all this. But the how it happens, the strategy, the tactics of how it's going to occur, it turns out there is not a worldwide movement with one direction, right, with one head, like it used to be years ago, and it didn't work, you know, with the idea of an alternative, which was the communist countries, and that did not work as a solution to this because it just didn't work as such, right? So we find ourselves with thousands and thousands of movements around the world representing millions and millions of people, and potentially billions of people, and all those people are full of experiences. Now, in a place like Porto Alegre, they were coming together, they were talking to each other, they were listening to one another, they were exchanging information, they were exchanging email because they were all on email, they had their cell phones, etc. You know, they were quite modern in that sense. And they were trying to figure out what to do next. And they were also influencing the people who had at Davos at the same time were there, right? Not only because, you know, they had the protests in Seattle and in Quebec and all these places and in Washington. It's partly that. And that certainly helps to put your body into the public arena. And I think that's very important, though. I really personally disagree with any violence in that sense. I think it takes away from our basic message. But from my point of view, what is most interesting is that there's a lot of thinking going on. And the thinking doesn't come from abstraction. It comes from very concrete experience of organizing communities one by one all over the world. And out of that, I think a world movement is beginning to grow. I think it's a very strange world movement. I don't think we very much know where it's going. But it's a world movement which I personally believe will not grow apart from the people who are in Davos, but will grow in conjunction with them, against them, and with them in a way. You know, I mean, there's sort of a back and forth that is going to be happening, and we're going to see how the world, you know, I mean, there's lots of very interesting movements, the sweatshop movement, the consumer movement, the fair trade, coffee. These are things that are affecting the ways in which people in countries that are powerful and rich have an influence upon countries that have other sorts of problems.
And how were the Davos people affected by these protests and by the forum in Brazil?
Well, I don't think they were too affected by the one in Brazil because the one in Brazil wasn't reported, hardly at all. I mean, this goes back to what we just said about journalists. You know, I mean, the journalists could have found this an interesting story after all. You know, you bring 15, 20,000 people from around the world. That's an extraordinary story. It wasn't reported hardly at all. I mean, you reported it, but there was hardly any interest. Their interest, if we had staged a riot, everybody would descend upon us, right? So 300 people were in Davos, and they were trying to block Davos. They were trying to do it through barricades. Those 300 people in Davos who were shouting and screaming but were not speaking about ideas at all were much more important. They had 30 times more airtime around the world than the 20,000 people in Porto Alegre who were speaking about a new world. And that's something we have to think about. In other words, how do we find a way of putting our ideas and our discussions upon the world screen? But, you know, it happens in as much as people begin to think about these things and organize in that way, right? I mean, one of the things I really think we have to do, and that I say that as a writer, is we have to be very imaginative. And imagination is something that I as a writer think that we just don't have enough of. We don't have enough of that, and we don't have enough humor, I must tell you. Because I think one of the things that called my attention, and I said in my keynote address in Porto Alegre, you know, I said, listen, you know, it turns out that when I'm with you guys around a table, we're drinking, you know, a beer or something like that, you guys are the funniest people in the world. But as soon as you get up on a podium, you become so solemn and so somber and so terrible and everything is horrible. And hey, how about a bit of humor? How about imagination? Because then you give the impression that what we want is a world where people are going to laugh much more than they do.
Censorship. Have you dealt with censorship in your own work?
Constantly. I mean, constantly. I'm constantly speaking about censors. I have a play called Reader where it is about a censor, and it's a short story as well. But fundamentally, I'm interested in self-censorship. I'm interested in why people decide not to say certain things because they're afraid. And I think Blake's therapy is also about censorship in a way. It's about who edits the world, who narrates the world, who edits it for us, who selects certain scenes so the world can go along without any ripples and any effects, without anything wrong with it.
Finally, I just wanted to ask you about your work with your sons.
Yeah, well, this is wonderful. It turns out, I don't know how many people do this, but I work with both my sons. With Rodrigo, I've written a couple of plays. We've done a film for the BBC with John Hurt. We've directed a film together, and we work all the time. In other words, we work all my audiovisual work I do with my eldest son. But I've also written a script with my youngest son, Joaquin, who's now only 22. And we have a project which is doing the rounds at this moment, which we wrote together, which I think may be a film very, very soon. And it's just a joy to be able to go back to the relationship that fathers and sons and mothers and daughters in that sense also have had during most of our human evolution. You know, we live in a world which is very strange, where the fathers and the sons do not work together. On the contrary, they're separate. There's even a generation gap. And what my son always says, Rodrigo, when they ask him how strange it is that you're working with your dad, he says, no, the strange thing is all the people who don't work with their fathers, you know.
Ariel Dorfman, I want to thank you very much for being with us. His latest book is Blake's Therapy, a novel. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan, our engineer. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.